So I thought we haven't really talked very much about Amitabha himself as a Buddha. We talked quite a bit yesterday about the ideas around it and the Pure Land. So I thought today we'd just focus a bit more on Amitabha. So here's a depiction of him here. Maybe before we do that, let's just do a review. Anything from yesterday you'd like to talk about, ask about?
Well, you talked about on happiness, you talked on Vedana and karma,
yeah.
Happiness and friendliness.
Yeah.
I suppose it's the same in Metta Bhavana with feeling and intention.
Yeah.
So yeah. You can't really cultivate the feeling, but you can work with it.
Very important that. As some of you know, probably about 12 years ago, I had a crisis, spiritual crisis, such that it took me away. I'd left the movement and went and got a job and gave up because in despair because I just seemed to be getting absolutely nowhere. There were a number of strands to that, and one of the strands was the whole, say, the Metta Bhavana. I just felt that I'd been practicing for 25 years and failing every time. Fail, 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 fail. You don't mind failing sometimes, but failing the whole time can be a bit demoralising. And one of my mistakes was to think that the success in the Metta Bhavana is measured by feeling. I should somehow feel something when I'm doing the Metta Bhavana. If I'm not feeling anything, it's failing. But my mistake was to confuse Vedana with karma. So karma is intention, let's say, and Vedana is feeling. And you haven't really got any control over Vedana. You can't make yourself feel good, happy, pleasurable when you're not. It comes to you, sort of thing. It's a result of what's happened previously. In ACT therapy, they say that feelings are history, which is an interesting way of putting it. Feelings are history. Feelings are the result of history. That's more, yeah. The way you feel now is a result of all sorts of things that have happened in the past leading up to this moment. You've got absolutely no control over the past. You do have a little measure of control over the future, and that's what karma is all about. Karma is intention. You're working now for future. Sometimes it happens in the present. As John Lennon famously wrote, there is such a thing as instant karma, but it's only one aspect of karma. Much karma happens, you know, the results happen in the future. So when you're doing the Metta Bhavana, I always think it's best not to expect anything at all. Just do the Metta Bhavana, keep on doing it, and it will have an effect. It may never have an effect in the meditation itself. So it's a mistake also, I think, to measure success or failure based on your subjective experience of meditating. Yeah. But, you know, in a few years' time, you might find that people are talking about you as being a kind person. Just before my crisis, I was working in a retreat centre leading study seminars, and at the end of study seminars there was always feedback, you know. And so many people talked about how kind I was, and it just didn't make sense to me. Oh, Atnagun, you're so kind. And I thought, they must be projecting, you know. So I'm just not kind. I never ever feel kind. And then I realised, what do you expect kindness to feel like, actually? You know. And there was a time when I used to ride a bicycle, and I was just locking it or unlocking it, I can't remember, to a lamppost. I heard a bang and I looked up. And as I looked up, I saw somebody falling to the ground on the road. And what happened, the few seconds afterwards, I worked out what happened. A car had hit someone. That was the bang. And I looked up and I saw them falling onto the road. They just lied there on the road. Still, and everything went completely still. It's like everything stopped, everyone stopped, all the cars stopped, not a sound. Everything's just like, And suddenly, it was a boy of about 14, he suddenly got up and freaked out. And he ran to the pavement, and a woman took off her coat and put it round him. A man picked him up and put it on the back seat, and I suppose a number of people dialed 999. That was the end of the incident. Now, think about this. If you'd have interviewed any one of the people involved in that, the woman putting the coat round the boy, the man picking the boy up, if you'd have said, how did you feel? They'd have said, no idea. You know, shaken up. You know, did you feel kind? Hey? You know, when you're being kind, you don't feel kind, do you? You don't think, oh, I'm feeling kind. I think I'll... Or somebody's, how are you doing today? Oh, I feel really kind today. Because kind is not a feeling, it's an intention. Yeah? So it's a really big mistake, I think, to measure your spiritual progress on how you're feeling. Feeling is just happens to you. It's completely passive. Intention is action. Anything else coming out of yesterday?
Only that the music was beautiful.
I'm glad one person thought so.
Yeah. It worked.
It worked for you. Worked for you? Yeah. Great. Yeah. That's good.
I was expecting something oriental, I don't know why. It's like something Indian or whatever, so it came as a surprise.
Ah.
Yeah. It was a pleasant surprise.
Ah, yeah. All.
It's so much more powerful than I had expected it to be.
Mm.
And then I thought, it shouldn't be too tingle tiny, because of course the Sukhavati is of course full of power.
Yeah, it's a powerful place. It's
not a pretty
place. It's it's reality, so really impinging.
Yeah. For me too.
Yes.
It was great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
It was the first time I heard music at the retreat center.
Yeah. Yeah, it was three pieces of music put together. I'll write it up on the board in there, but the tinkling, those little bits of music, that was, you know what I mean? But it's the hitting the violin with all on one note. There were several movements of Sofia Gubaidulina. Do you know Sofia Gubaidulina, the Ukrainian composer? Her second symphony. Symphony number 2. In 12 movements, and the movements are like small. So a few of those. The choir was, it's actually a long choir piece by an English composer called Ronald Corp on the Dhammapada, verses from the Dhammapada, but it starts with Buddhang Saranangacchami. And I went to see it in Brighton at the Brighton Festival. Never heard it before. And it starts with this. Completely electrifying. She's like, Buddhang Saranang. She's like, whoa! Suffused with bliss and pleasure and, wow, amazing. So I took that. That's the Buddhang Saranangacchami. And the middle bit, the birds, and then does anybody recognise that piece? Do you know that piece?
It was a bird, yeah.
Yeah? Cantus Arcticus by the Finnish composer Rautavaara. Second movement. So each movement starts with birds singing. And then the orchestra comes in. It's a pity that one of the tracks that had been corrupted that I couldn't play you last night was the third movement, which starts with swans. Loads and loads of swans. You know, like in a... like in a nature program, you see thousands of birds like that, and then the orchestra comes in. Amazing. But you liked it, yeah? So I'll download it again from iTunes and see if we can put it together, if you can work with me on it again. And we'll play that later today. Good. Great. And how did you get on beforehand with the reading? Reading? What reading? How did you get on with that?
It came up a little bit too long for me.
To
be really engaged all the time.
too long.
Yeah, okay. A little bit too long. Yeah. It's very good to hear it. But that's nice.
It's interesting to see your mind drifting away, not being able to take in all the descriptions going on and going on, sort of.
Yeah.
And then you drift away, and then I come back, and then drift away.
Just like the mindfulness of breathing.
Yeah.
I like the way to think about different Buddhas, different dimensions, and the bigger perspective. It makes me feel so richer and more expanded and not so narrow.
Yeah.
I like that.
Okay. But the last night's reading wasn't really about that. It was more local, wasn't it? It's all the things quite close to you. Yeah? Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
Yeah.
Perhaps I had the broader perspective.
You could have. One of the interesting things is that I don't know if you were present at this point where your mind was, but it starts off with railings.
Yeah.
Seven rows of railings, so there's a border, but in another part of the sutra it says that the Pure Land is limitless. That's very interesting, isn't it? It's got borders, but it's limitless. So how does that work? And I often think that it's the pictorial representation of form and emptiness from the Heart Sutra. Form is only emptiness, only form is the railings. And emptiness is the fact that there aren't really any railings, or the railings are infinitely large.
I think it's very nice with all the texts, because they are so poetic, or so written.
Yes.
They're very beautiful texts.
The Pure Land imagery doesn't suit everybody. Some people I know say, I prefer real trees and grass and mud. And, do you feel that way?
I kind of like it, because I have a very pictorial mind, so I got all these lovely pictures coming up all the time. And also my cognitive mind said, there's golden sand in the lotus pond. Lotus likes mud.
Yeah.
How is this going to work?
Exactly, and, that's it.
I enjoyed all that. So there's red and gold and dark blue and white, and then there's multicolored. How do they look? But I really liked it. I liked all this, and it was also nice to see how my brain, my mind wanted to sort of, they're going to repeat this again and again and again. And what we talked about, how these suttas are sort of constructed, they're repeating it, and sort of making the mind sort of trying to sort of making it tired and unhook, making it to unhook and just letting the world sort of go over you. And I think it really works that way.
Yeah, so Viveka is referring to a conversation we had yesterday in our small group about the way Mahayana sutras work. So they, you know, the way we read, we sit down in a chair with a book and we read silently to ourselves. They're not really meant for that. And so they don't work very well. You know, you try to read them and you fall asleep and your mind wanders. You can only read a page or two and that's enough. You know, it's like eating chocolate, it's just too much. But they're not really meant for that. When these were written, this one, probably written about first century, and not many people could read in those days in India. It was still very much an oral society. So they were read to them. So people would go into a shrine room, do a ritual, and in the midst of that ritual, the sutra would be read. So you'd be completely passive. You'd just be allowing it in. And Sangrachta was reading a few years ago now. He's reading a book called Zen Pure Land, Pure Land Zen. Because in China and Japan, all the schools kind of got mixed together. And it's a very common combination, Zen and Pure Land together. And the writer of this book says that, and Sangharakshi was really struck by that, and he quoted him. The writer of this book says, Mahayana Sutras, when you listen to them, you mustn't think. Yeah. They're not to be thought about. Now, can we just not think? No. So what happens is, at first, your conceptual mind is working, as it normally does. Lotuses the size of cartwheels. Wait a minute, how does that feel? You know, sand? Well, lotuses, they need mud. Your conceptual mind is working away, and then the sutra might make a point about something. There might be a Dharma teaching, all things are impermanent. Or let's say from the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Manjushri asks Vimalakirti, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings? And Vimalakirti gives this great long answer, like, you know, a paragraph long. And basically it's just saying, as empty. You know, a bodhisattva should regard all living beings as empty. But he just says it over and over again in different ways. And when you read it, you think, yeah, I've got it now. And you sort of skip to the end. What's next? But if it's being read to you, you can't skip. You can't fast forward, you know. So, and the idea is, you haven't got it, actually. You've only got it intellectually. All beings are empty. Oh, yeah, I know that. So what's the next thing? It's almost like the sutra saying, you haven't got it. I'm going to say it again now, in a different way. And you still haven't got it. I'm going to keep saying it over and over and over again, because you want to move on to the next thing, but you haven't got this bit yet. You haven't understood. And how do you understand? You've already understood it with your conceptual mind. Yeah, that's done. Now you need to really take it in with the whole of your being. And that's the point of Mahayana Sutras. It's understood. Yeah, Mahayana, the authors, whoever they were of Mahayana Sutras, it's taken for granted that you know the early Buddhist teachings. It's taken for granted because they mentioned them. You know, last night, three lists were mentioned, weren't they? The five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, and the seven bodhiyangas. Do you know them? Okay, you're not ready for a Mahayana Sutra then. Go back to lesson one. Read your text. Mahayana Sutra writers, like, right, you know all that now. Yeah, that's your basis. You've got all that. Now you need to really understand it. How do you really understand it? You've got to take it in, yeah? And it's now they're working in imaginatively. You've got the concepts, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Paths, Five Spiritual Faculties. You've got all that conceptually. Not enough. Now it's got to enter the whole of your being, including your imagination. So that's what the sutras are doing. And we don't like that when we read them, because our conceptual mind wants more to chew on. Yeah. Okay. Still haven't talked about Amitabha, have we? Anything else from yesterday before we move on to Amitabha himself? No. Okay. So,
you're going to repeat everything you say three times now?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Okay, so Amitabha.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how many of you have read Sangharakshita's memoirs, but I think it's towards the end of The Thousand Petaled Lotus. He writes about a problem in living the spiritual life, the problem being the self. So, you know, I, as a self, envisage myself practicing the spiritual life and eventually gaining enlightenment. But it's all based on a complete misunderstanding, because it's all self-driven, yeah? So, if the self is an illusion, how do you move from self-reference, self-understanding, to non-self-understanding? Because all the time, as we're practicing, we're conceiving it as I'm practicing. But there's no I to practice. So that's the big problem, yeah. So it's, in England, there's a phrase, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Do you know that one? Have you got that one? So the whole idea is that you have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but of course that's impossible. But in a way, that's what we're trying to do, living this spiritual life. We're trying to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Do you have a different one from the head? Oh, yeah. You're trying to do that to yourself. Yeah, yeah. So how do you get over that problem? This was Sangharakshita's problem at a certain time in his spiritual life, and he decided that the only way was to give himself up to someone else. So he had a teacher at that time, Jagdish Kashyap, and he decided to just give up his own self-willing to his teacher. So his teacher was a very... Jagdish Kashyap was a very modest man. He didn't think of himself as a great teacher or anything. So they were travelling, and Sangharakshita decided whatever Jagdish wanted, Sangharakshita would just go along with it. So Jagdish would say, well, should we stop here for a cup of tea? And Sangharakshita, would you like to? He said, yes, we'll do that then. So whatever, yeah, he just gave his own will up to Jagdish Kashyap. So this is a way of living the spiritual life. And you could say that Ananda did that with the Buddha. One of the interesting things about Ananda is he was very close to the Buddha, probably his closest friend. And he stayed with him for the last 20 years of the Buddha's life. They were cousins as well, actually, so they'd known each other all their lives. And for the last 20 years of the Buddha's life, Ananda was his constant companion. He heard every teaching the Buddha gave, yeah, and he remembered it. At the end of the Buddha's life, Ananda was still not enlightened. Loads of other people were, but not Ananda. Isn't that funny? Even people who met the Buddha for the first time gained enlightenment sometimes there on the spot. And Ananda, who knew him all his life and spent 20 years with him, wasn't enlightened. Yeah. Soon after the death of the Buddha, the senior most disciples got together and they did this sanghiti, they did this chanting together of all the teachings that they knew. They wanted to gather them all together. And of course Ananda was really, really important in that, because he'd been at just about every one of them and he had this amazing memory. He remembered everything. So they needed him there, but they only wanted people who were enlightened. So Ananda couldn't come. So what did he do? He went to the forest and meditated until he was enlightened, and then he came to the meeting. Yeah. So right at the end, he did it. Now that's really interesting, isn't it? All those 20 years and he didn't do it. Why? We don't really know why, but perhaps it was because he wasn't really concerned about his own spiritual development. He was concerned with the Buddha. His life's work was not to gain enlightenment, but was to serve the Buddha. That was what his life was all about. Banti once said that you could see Ananda as the first bodhisattva. Yeah, someone who puts off his own enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And when he really needed to gain enlightenment, he did. But he didn't really need to before that.
But then again, for all other beings, gain enlightenment too.
Yeah.
Service to the
Sangeet. Yeah, 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 at the end he did that, yeah. So, fantastic symbol of service. So you could say Ananda just gave himself up to the Buddha. That's one way of living the spiritual life. And Amitabha is very much to do with that, or he became very much to do with that in the Chinese and Japanese Pure Land traditions. So let's say a few words about Amitabha now. I've already told you what his name means. So Amita is very important. Amita, measureless, boundless, limitless, eternal, infinite, without borders. it's very often understood kind of literally, but you can understand it very metaphorically. So once the Buddha was asked, what happens to an enlightened person after death? Do they carry on living? Or are they completely snuffed out? Those are the two options this man had in mind. You either carry on eternally or you go completely. So what happens to a Buddha? And the Buddha said, neither of those two options really apply, actually. Because you're conceptualizing. They're concepts, they're ideas about, carrying on or stopping. That's just the way the mind works. The mind works, it's either this or that. And it's you can't really say it's beyond measuring what happens to an enlightened being at death. We cannot measure. Yeah, can't compute, you could say. So you could understand Amita in that sense, that Amita is mystery. It's the mystery of enlightenment. Because the trouble is, because we're so conceptual, we say, what's enlightenment? Oh, enlightenment is wisdom, compassion, freedom, liberation. Oh, okay. Then you think you know what it is, because you've got the concept. Because we haven't got the faintest idea, not the faintest idea what it is. It's completely mysterious. It's mystery. In the Tibetan phrase, Amaho. Do you know that? Amaho. Brilliant phrase. It just means, Amaho. Whoa. No idea. Completely mysterious. So Amita is a mystery. It's the mystery. Can't be measured. Can't be tied down to our conceptual mind. So Amitabha, infinite light. So space, infinite space. Amitayus, infinite life, time. Yeah. Because we even tie time and space down, don't we? But they can't be tied down. So that's the kind of philosophical element of Amitabha. But of course, he's much more than that. And you could then ask, why did the Mahayana come up with all these Buddhas? Isn't the Buddha enough? Shakyamuni, the Buddha, isn't he enough? Can't we just go back to him? And so at the time of the Buddha, very often Buddhists would have met the Buddha at least once, so they've got this connection with him, felt connection, personal connection with the Buddha. And I'm guessing that when the Buddha died, they really missed that. There was a sense of lack. They heard about the Buddha, you know, they talked about the Buddha with people who'd met the Buddha before, so there was this connection with another through another person with the Buddha for a while, but then of course that generation died. Now that connection is gone. Now they've just got the teachings. No Buddha anymore, just Dharma. Yeah, Dharma and Sangha. There's no Buddha anymore. And my guess is that they really missed the Buddha. They missed him as a person. So then they began to take up the Buddhanusati practice. And the Buddhanusati practice was first taught as you get a list of the Buddha's qualities and you reflect on them. You reflect on those Buddha qualities. But as time went by, it became more a kind of visualization of the Buddha. Why did it take that form? Perhaps because people wanted to embody these concepts, because they were concepts, you know, wisdom, compassion, kindness, brilliance, all that kind of thing. They're ideas, but you want to put them into a person who embodies those ideas. You could say that there is no wisdom, there is just wise people. Yeah, wisdom is embodied in persons in the same way that compassion is embodied in persons. So they wanted to embody these qualities, so they began to imagine him. And of course, we've got no idea what the Buddha looked like, actually. Well, he was Indian, so we've got some idea. Probably had dark hair and darker skin than we've got. That's what we know. Was he short? Was he long? Tall? Doesn't say, does it, in the text? It doesn't say he was 5'6". Don't know. They say he was incredibly beautiful, handsome, blue-black hair, but was he really? You know, who knows? We don't know what he looks like. So now we have to imagine, what did the Buddha look like? And I think probably what happened is people started doing the Buddhanusati practice, trying to get in touch with the Buddha. And then what happens is the imagination takes over. And you've got this conceptual idea, well, it probably looks a bit like this. Let's imagine him like this. It's all very conscious. And then if you keep on doing that, your unconscious, the imagination, begins to come in. And suddenly you've got this quite different Buddha who you never imagined before, suddenly appearing before you. I think that's probably what happened, because multiple Buddhas, you know, Amitabha, Akshobhya, Ratnasambhava, they began to appear a few hundred years after the death of the Buddha. Amitabha was one of them. Now, I've mentioned Akshobhya and Ratnasambhava, and those of you who have been around the Triratna movement for a while, you're thinking Amitabha red, Akshobhya blue, Ratnasambhava golden yellow. But they weren't in the early days. Amitabha was golden. Yeah? All Buddhas in the sutras are golden. Yeah? They weren't these different colours. So when you read the sutras, all Buddhas are the colour of gold. Yeah? Why? The most precious metal they had in those days. The most precious. And the most beautiful, perhaps. Yeah? Gold. Have you seen gold things in the sunlight? Yeah? Yeah, brilliant, isn't it? Absolutely brilliant. So they imagined the Buddha as golden. Yeah, incredible. So, now you've got Buddhanusati embodied in some kind of imaginative embodiment of the Buddha. In other words, an imaginative embodiment of the Dhamma. And there were various ways that you can respond to that. Some people, it seemed, managed to have a personal relationship with the Buddha that they imagined. Yeah. Now, Westerners, we often think of it in terms of what you're imagining. So it's an aspect of your consciousness that you're projecting out there. Yeah, that's the way we often think, isn't it? But the ancient Indians wouldn't have thought like that at all. If they imagined the Buddha was there. Naive realism, there was the Buddha. So, oh, I'll ask him a question. So you can start getting into a dialogue with the Buddha. Amazing, quite amazing. And this is what happens in the Pratyutpanna Samadhi Sutra. You actually begin to ask questions of the Buddha and you receive your teachings from this Buddha. So it's as if that now there is another being there that you're in relation with. Not an aspect of your consciousness that you projected out there onto a blue sky, but actually another being. I'm talking here very traditionally. So now you get into this relationship and you can receive teachings from that Buddha. But also, you can receive their compassion. Yeah? And this is where Amitabha really comes in, isn't it? Because when you get the five Buddha mandala, with Virochana in the centre, Virochana being the central Buddha, dazzling white colour, and then you've got Amoghasiddhi in the north, dark green colour, Akshobhya in the east, dark blue colour, Ratnasambhava in the south, golden yellow colour, and Amitabha in the west, deep red. So then Amitabha, in that Buddha mandala, of course, represents the west. He represents the time of day where the sun is. So the sun sets in the west. So he represents the end of the day, the setting of the sun. When your work is done, and you can get on with the spiritual life, so you can sit down and meditate. So he represents particularly meditation. So he sits in Dhyana Mudra. Yeah, this Dhyana, that's his mudra. Because he represents meditation. And he particularly represents contemplation. Contemplation. And his deep red colour began to represent deep compassion. So what began to happen with the Pure Land schools is that towards the end of the Shorter Sukhavati Viewha Sutra, the Buddha talks about Buddhas in all directions. He talks about Amitabha for a very short while, and then he talks about, well, in the north, there are all these Buddha lands, and he mentions a few of them, four or five of them, with all the Buddhas in them, four or five different Buddhas. And in the south, you've got these. So you end up with 38 Buddha fields all around you. And then he uses this phrase, embraced by all the Buddhas. Yeah? And he says, you can call this text, if you want to, embraced by all the Buddhas. So it's got a second name now. Not only is it called the Shorter Sukhavivyuha Sutra, it can also be called the Sutra on embraced by all the Buddhas. Now, embraced by the Buddhas suggests something coming to you from out there. Yeah, that's the suggestion. And this is what the Pure Land schools really began to work with, this idea of a Buddha figure coming in the form of Amitabha, coming to us. And they began to envisage the spiritual life as being, the Chinese schools began to envisage the spiritual life as being partly you have to work, you have to practice ethics, you have to have the pranidhana, the heartfelt, you could say intense desire, and then you practice ethics, and then you meditate on the name Amitabha, or Amitayas, Amita, you meditate on the name. And then Amitabha embraces you. Yeah? Yeah. So you have to become ready for that embrace. That's what the spiritual life is all about. Now, often Theravada Buddhists and many Western Buddhists don't really like that way of looking at it. It's like the self all the way. The self overcomes the self and you, as a person, become enlightened. That's a perfectly okay way of looking at it. Very traditional early Buddhist Theravada way of understanding the spiritual life. You have to do all the work, all the way to enlightenment. But there is another way of looking at it, that you work, but there comes a point, many of us have reached this point actually, where you work, and you think, I'm getting nowhere. It just doesn't seem to be working. Much as I try, I cannot pull myself up by my bootstraps. So now what am I going to do? And at that point, if you want to, or sometimes you have to, you open yourself up to the grace waves, the Adishtana of the Buddhas. And that's what Amitabha represents. So a few hundred years after the first two sutras, the two Sukhavativyuha sutras are written, in China, 400 common era, Tan Wan. Tan Wan came up with the idea of self-help and outside help, often translated as self-power and other power. It was Tan Wan in China who first came up with that distinction. And that became a central doctrine of Pure Land Buddhism. And in China, it meant just what I've said, that you have to work as far as you can, and then you just have to surrender. So surrender is a very important part of our Pure Land Buddhism. You surrender to Amitabha, which means that you give yourself up to the way things really are. You just let go. As in Kamala Sheela's poem yesterday, let the universe do what it wants. It will anyway. Yeah, that's what other power really means. Let the universe do what it wants. It will anyway. Yeah. So other power, giving up to other power, symbolises giving up control, which is a lot what the spiritual life is about, isn't it? Giving up the idea of that you can control things. Let that go. Later, quite a few hundred years later, in the 11th, 12th century in Japan, you get Honen and Shinman, who took self-power to its absolute extreme. And what they were saying is, actually, you can't do anything. You as a self are so completely deluded, you can do nothing. All you can do is give yourself up to other power. They took it right to that extreme. And what they said is, self-power practice is an expression of doubt in Amitabha's other power. We don't need to go to that extreme, because I think that really is quite an extreme. But what that means then is we're back to that position of do it now. Give yourself up now. Have you done it? No. Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to use self-power then. Yeah. You're obviously not ready to give yourself up completely at the moment, so you have to go back to self-power. But what Shinman and Honen were trying to do was get people to just do it right now. It's almost like instantaneous enlightenment. So self-power and other power. Later on today, I think we'll do an exercise where we, a physical thing, where we try to give up self-power to another. But that's for later on today. How are we doing for time? Oh, nearly time for tea break. So, I think I'll finish with the idea of the red Buddha. Let's go back to red. So, the mantra, Om Amideva Frihi. Shouldn't it be Amitabha Frihi? It's funny, isn't it? Where did Amideva come from? No one really knows. Some people think it's a Tibetan corruption of Amitabha, the Sanskrit Amitabha. Who knows? But what I want to focus on now is the final syllable, hui. Let's write it in red. Hui. So, H at the end, some people pronounce it hui-hi, but there's no I at the end of that. It's not hui-hi, it's hui. There's almost silent H at the end of it, hui. Yeah. And it's what's known as his seed syllable, the seed syllable is like the essence. So the essence of Amitabha is in the hui, so in his heart. You could imagine in his heart is a red lotus, white moon mat, and on the red lotus is the seed syllable, which in Sanskrit is one letter. We'll see if we can find it somewhere. Hui, right in the centre of his heart. That's the essence of Amitabha, which is the essence of wisdom and compassion. interestingly enough, that the Sanskrit word hui also means shame. So in early Buddhism, you get what are called the two guardians of the world are Hui and Otapa. Yeah, Hui is your own sense of ethical values. Yeah. So by shame, what I mean is a sense of conscience. You could say Hui is conscience. Otapa is your sense of your friends and your teachers' ethical values. Yeah. So when you do something unskillful, as we all do, you'll probably feel hui, but you might also feel a sense of you've let your friends down a bit, you've let your teacher down, I've done this, I've let them down a little bit. Yeah. I think it's two T's and one P, Otapa.
I think we usually talk about
Apatrapya in the Sanskrit. I can't spell that. Now, what's interesting is hui is Amitabha's seed syllable. And have you heard of Lama Anagarika Govinda? So when I was new to Buddhism 40 years ago, 39 years ago to be precise, he was one of three teachers that we all read in those days. Sangharakshita, Edward Conza, and Lama Anagarika Govinda. They all knew each other, and there was, in my mind, they were a trio. And Lama Govinda, German, but a real Tibetan, you know, a lover of Tibet, and he lived out there, and Banti and Govinda got on very, very well together. And Govinda wrote this really interesting article on Hui. And he points this out. He says, isn't it interesting that Hui, the seed syllable of Amitabha, is also the sense of ethical values, and it's the sense of shame when you don't live up to your ethical values. And he says, and it's also interesting that when you do something like that, the appropriate thing is to go red. Yeah? When you've let yourself down, when you've done something you shouldn't do, you should go red. He said, now young people in these days, they don't go red anymore. They don't have that sense of shame. It's what old people say about young people the world over, isn't it? You don't have the sense of shame that we used to have. But we should go red. And our going red is like the Dharma coming back. And we're saying to the whole world, I'm back now in the Dharma. I'm sorry for what I've done. So it's almost like a beacon, a light, saying Amitabha's light shining through you and going, I've let myself down, but I'm coming back into the Dharma. Brilliant, isn't it? Isn't that brilliant? So, compassion and shame. Now, shame is an awkward word, because in England, in psychology, shame means one thing, but in our Buddhist movement, it's a different word. It means something else. Yeah.
I think as psychologists, shame is very
negative.
Necessary.
Motivation. Ah, okay.
Not necessarily seen negatively.
Ah, okay.
It binds us in relationship with others.
Okay, that's good.
It's more of a compass.
Okay, that's great. So you could use the word regret, that you really regret having done something which has hurt you and other people. So yeah, it's like Hui and this sense of regret and compassion are very, very closely linked. So what you might find sometimes is you're doing the Metta Bhavana and you're thinking about somebody and you're trying to develop love, and then you realise something that you've done in relation to that person isn't great actually. Yeah, and you kind of knew it beforehand, but you've kind of put it to the side. Ooh, you try to ignore it, but then you do the Metta Bhavana and that person comes up in your mind, and then you feel it again. Yeah, so now there's a barrier. Yeah, you're trying to develop metta towards them, but there's now this barrier between you because of what you've done, and then you feel the shame. Yeah, and then the shame builds the bridge back to that person again. The sense of regret builds the bridge. It may not be enough. You may need to go to that person and tell them what they've done and ask their forgiveness. Now, they now have to build their bridge back to you, because they might go, oh, I'm really annoyed at you. Oh, I feel really let down and I'm really angry with you. And you know, and that, now they've cut off from you. You've done your best to build the bridge back through your sense of shame, but now it's up to them. But you can only do your bit. And then forgiveness, yeah, forgiveness is involved in this too. So, shame and forgiveness, they're like the bridge that you build, there we are, yeah. Your shame goes that far, that's all you can do. Now, the person you've done wrong to, they now need to build their bridge of forgiveness and meet you in the middle. So, shame and forgiveness and compassion and love are all of the same. They're all to do with connection. So you could say that Amitabha, what he represents is connection. Yeah? Heartfelt connection.
This implies that someone else is involved, but you can also sense free when
you act unskillfully in your mind only.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a manifest action.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I guess the forgiveness needs to be built by myself also.
Yeah. It's as if also when we do something unskillful, we've acted against ourselves. Yeah. So in a certain sense, you've now you become unintegrated. Yeah, you're no longer integrated to your deeper self. And sometimes this is what happens, isn't it? You go on retreat, you've been working hard and you've done a few unskillful things, we haven't got time to think about it now. Then you go on retreat and it all comes back, doesn't it? You think, oh, I did that, and oh, I need to talk to her when I get back home. And it's almost like you're building bridges back to yourself, your inner self. And you're coming back into contact with your own heart. Yeah. Because when we're unskillful, it's almost like we get away from our own deep sense of heart connection to ourselves. And we need to come back into relationship with ourselves sometimes takes a bit of work, doesn't it? Sometimes it takes a bit of coming to terms with what we've done, a little bit of pain, some tears maybe. That's what it's like, isn't it? When you start to come back into yourself, it's like, ooh, a bit of a bumpy ride sometimes. Ooh, come back. And eventually, after some days, hopefully, you come back into real connection with your heart, your open heart. Yeah.